This recording is the property of the Winogrand Foundation and cannot be recorded, rebroadcast, or otherwise disseminated without the express permission of the Foundation. This is New York Academy of Sciences lecture for March 26, 2012, Syndemics in the Contemporary Global Health Transition by Merrill Singer at the University of Connecticut.
Really nice home here. Tonight we have a wonderful talk arranged as part of our pretty much monthly speaker series. My colleague Jeff Moskovsky will introduce our speaker for tonight. I am with Jeff, the co-chair of the anthropology section. My name is Rudy Gaudio, and I'm here to welcome you. Thank you for coming, and to tell you about our next talk, which is in a month on April 30th. They're always on Monday nights. And it's going to be here in this space. Ben Zimmer, the recent columnist on language for the New York Times, will be speaking here on The New Language Detectives, Investigating Linguistic Phenomena in a Data-Driven Age. And Bambi Shefflin from NYU will be the discussant for that talk. So put it on your calendar, Monday, April 30th. I'll now turn the floor over to my colleague, Jeff Moskovsky, to introduce our speaker for tonight.
Hello, everybody. Welcome. It's my pleasure to introduce Merrill Singer, our invited speaker for this evening. I met Merrill at a New York Academy of Sciences event on AIDS and anthropology, which was organized by Pat Antonello back in the 90s. But I don't know. Well, we just established that we weren't even sure if Merrill was there, which we realized that whether he was actually there in actual concrete physical presence or not, it was irrelevant because his impact on the field was so large that we imagined him being there whether he actually was truly there or not, which was a monumental event in putting together the Anthropology of AIDS, which was a New York Academy of Sciences event, so it's kind of appropriate to start off today by mentioning that, and Merrill's contribution to that, real or imagined. but I'm very pleased to introduce Merrill. He is a paragon of engaged research excellence. He is a professor in the Department of Anthropology and Community Medicine and a senior research scholar, senior research scientist at the Center for Health Intervention and Prevention at the University of Connecticut. Before that, he worked for 25 years as director of research and later as an associate director at the Hispanic Health Council in Hartford, Connecticut. Merrill's research and writing focus on health disparities, political ecology, and economy of health, HIV/AIDS in vulnerable populations, illicit drugs use and drinking, communities and structural violence. Most of you are familiar with his work, so I won't take the time to describe it in full detail. And besides, I couldn't, because he is the author or co-author of more than 250 articles and 24 books. So we'd be here all night if I actually tried to describe to you the enormous quantity and quality of his work. But I do want to mention a few highlights. His books include a classic in medical anthropology called Medical Anthropology and the World System, which he co-authored with Hans Baer and Ida Susser, who's also here. He has many other books and many articles. One of his latest books, which is interesting and which relates specifically to what he's going to talk about tonight, is An Introduction to Syndemics. A systems approach to public and community health. This is actually a term that Merrill has himself really envisioned and promoted in anthropology, and it's a thrill to have him here. Before I turn the podium over to him, I just want to say is the one thing that really strikes me as rather remarkable in Merrill's amazing career is his ability to do critical work and to create an enormous body of critical research and writing while negotiating the oftentimes vexing boundaries between government, community, activism, and academia. He's really one of the people who has really operated in all of these institutional contexts at once. And rather than viewing them or kind of bracketing them off from each other, Merrill has actually been able to bring them together into a critical kind of discussion and tension in ways that produce an amazing, amazing insights and incredibly important work that anthropology can claim as its own. So it's very exciting to have him here. It's very exciting to have, I'm looking very much forward to tonight's conversation, and then welcome Merrill. Please take it away.
Thank you, Jeff. And thank Werner Gren for letting us meet here. I guess that's a routine thing, to the New York Academy Anthro Section for inviting me, and for all of you for coming out tonight. It's a nice pleasure to. I don't get to New York. I'm not that far away, but I don't get here that often. I just wanted to let Jeff know that even though I was not at that event, I enjoyed it a great deal. I've never had a better time, in fact. And then again, probably 20 years from now, I won't remember I was here tonight, so it works out. I also wanted to compliment you all on having this arrangement where you have dinner together first, because that way, you know, the blood has left your brain, and your critical tendencies have been dampened, so I make for a nicer, friendlier crowd. So as Jeff indicated, the focus of my talk tonight is on syndemics, which I heard somebody inquire as to what that was, and fortunately I'm here to answer that question in the way I would like it answered. And I want to frame my discussion of syndemics in terms of differences in a global health profile as we're entering deeper into the 21st century, as contrasted with epidemiological and public health expectations and projections made in the middle of the mid to late 20th century. Now let's try out this system. Okay, it's not that one. In his classic paper, The Epidemiological Transition, A Theory of the Epidemiology of Population Change, published in 1971, Abdel Amran identified three epidemiological eras in human history and a unidirectional pathway of epidemiological transitions common to all societies. In the first of these eras, the age of pestilence and famine, as he called it, the world of human health was shaped by deadly ravages of war, famine, and plagues. The second era, he called the age of receding pandemics, which was characterized by the benefits of the historic march of modern medicine, especially the discovery of pathogens as a cause of infectious disease and the development of antibiotics and other acclaimed biomedical interventions. The result was, as he viewed it, a dramatic decline in death rates, and a notable jump in population size. Finally, there is the age of degenerative and man-made disease, during which mortality due to infectious disease continues to decline, while the chronic diseases of modernity, from diabetes to cardiovascular disease to cancer, become the most frequent causes of death. That's interesting. What now? At the time Amran was developing his theory of epidemiological transition, global health experts at the World Health Organization were projecting a global convergence of expected life spans at about 75 years, as reflected in this slide, reflecting a shared frame of thinking among epidemiologists and other health experts. And events in the world appeared to be justifying this view of the expected course of human health through time. Countries like the United States, Western Europe, Japan, were seeing life expectancy rise and converge at about 75 years, while developing nations appear to be gaining control of infectious diseases. The landmark eradication of smallpox, historically one of the most devastating diseases of human childhood during the 1970s, provided powerful support for the expectations of health in the 21st century. Characteristic of this worldview, in 1963, the widely respected physician and anthropologist, T. Aidan Cockburn, in a book called The Evolution and Eradication of Infectious Disease, stated, "We can look forward with confidence to a considerable degree of freedom from infectious diseases at a time not too far in the future. Indeed, it seems reasonable to anticipate within some measurable time all the major infections will have disappeared." A few years later, in the late 1960s, Dr. William H. Stewart, the Surgeon General of the U.S., is alleged to have said, he denied it, "It is time to close the book on infectious diseases," during a presentation at the Association of State and Territorial Health Officers held in D.C. Many people quote him on that. He says he didn't say it. It's interesting. By this point, and as reflected in the sharp drop in funding in infectious disease research and in the attention paid to infectious disease in medical school curricula and textbooks, it had come to be widely presumed in the halls of medicine that, in the global north at least, infection would soon become an artifact of human history. At the time, Anthony Fauci, now the director of the U.S. National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, was just finishing his medical school residency and heading to NIH to begin a fellowship in infectious disease. In the 2005 Milbank Memorial Fund, Robert H. Ebert lecture on academic medicine and the public interest, Fauci noted, "You can imagine how I felt after several years of internal medicine residency, preparing myself for a subspecialty in which public health leaders were telling me directly and indirectly that I was wasting my time because there was little left to do in infectious disease." As we all know, history has shown that rather than wasting his time, Fauci and the rest of us were, from the standpoint of disease, about to enter a rather unexpected 21st century as a consequence of AIDS and much that has followed its appearance on the stage of human health experience. Also, various researchers from several disciplines have subsequently pointed out telling flaws in Omron's model, while ensuing events in the world of infectious disease have triggered significant rethinking about the conception of epidemiological transition altogether. Anthropologist Ron Barrett, for example, has drawn attention to two particular shortcomings of Omron's model. First, Omron's first era presupposes... Why can't I get my classes to laugh at this cartoon? They just look at it and don't get it. Thank you for that clarification. So I will tell them, you'll be getting this joke in about 10 years. First, Omron, as Ron Barrett accurately points out, Omron's first era presupposes that peoples of the industrial world suffered a heavy burden of infectious disease. Anthropological research, however, of course, questions this assumption, noting that the long sweep of human history during which foraging was the most complex productive technology, a period that constituted the majority of Homo sapien life on the planet, was probably characterized by low rates of infectious disease because band size and mobility would not have supported a highly acute and virulent infectious outbreaks. Instead, foraging selected for the type of low virulence infections seen in the so-called heirloom pathogens found among higher primates. The critical transition point, however, was the development and spread of agriculture and its accompanying increase in group size and comparatively settled lifeways. As Barrett observes, the rise in the number of infectious agents and significant increase in their adverse impact on agricultural peoples was the weakening, was driven by increased population density, decreased dietary diversity, and greater proximity to zoonotic pathogens undergoing adaptive movement to nearby and numerous human hosts. Also of note was the widening gap in social statuses and access to vital material and reproductive and productive resources, with associated declines in the life expectancy of subaltern social strata. From this point on, inattention to class and other social divisions in health was an erasure of significant proportions. The second shortcoming of Amran's formulation involves the disappointing declines in infectious disease in developing nations, despite the emergence of increased rates of chronic disease. As a result, the majority populations of the developing nations of Latin America, Asia, and Africa, and elsewhere now suffer from what David Bradley called the worst of both worlds. Moreover, with the emergence and global spread of AIDS from Africa and subsequent very rapid spread of SARS from Asia to North America, a new unexpected era of disease had indeed arrived. This new stage of human contestation with disease, which Armelgos and colleagues christened the actual third epidemiological transition, has been described as a revisiting of the past, a return to a time of infectious disease, or, as Crosby has characterized it, the 19th century was followed by the 20th century, which was followed by the 19th century. Central to this era, from a public health perspective, is the appearance in rapid succession of a set of emerging and re-emerging infectious diseases in the midst of increasing rates of chronic disease in developed and developing nations alike, although not necessarily in identical ways or evenly distributed across social strata. Since about 1975, previously unknown infectious diseases have surfaced at an astonishing pace of about one per year, mostly caused by newly discovered viruses, changing human technologies and environmental intrusions, the weakening of public health structures, infrastructures, deterioration of socioeconomic conditions, and the heightened frequencies of social conflict. The concept of emerging infectious diseases, which itself has emerged as a new medical and research specialty, has replaced the older notion of an unfinished agenda of infectious disease. Thus, a 2006 Medline keyword search for communicable diseases emerging, for example, found that five times more medical journal articles were written on emerging infectious diseases during the previous 4 years than in the previous 100 years. Similarly, a Google Ngram search of published books for the term new infections shows a significant jump beginning in the late 1980s. Additionally, as Armelgos and co-workers affirm, today, with the increased use of antibiotics, we are facing a third epidemiological transition, a reemergence of older infectious disease with pathogens that are antibiotic resistant and have the potential to be transmitted on a global scale. In the case of TB, for example, we now have strains that are resistant to every known treatment that we have. Rapid and almost instant global transmission of new diseases has been linked to globalization. Driving this world congress of changes are a set of transnational capitalist economic processes. As Greaves observes, at its heart, globalization involves corporations, technology, and capital. More precisely, it is a process of rapid internationalization and integration of commercial enterprises supported by global communication technologies and global deployment of financial capital. With globalization, things, including capital, technology, commodities, people, and infectious diseases, move quickly in life and death shaping flows touching all inhabited corners of the world. While it is evident that new infectious diseases are appearing in quick order, and that globalism is an important part of the social context for this change, a critical feature of the contemporary epidemiological era is not just new infections and the resurrections of old ones, but the complex interaction of diseases, new and old, with significant consequence for human morbidity and mortality, a dynamic that I've labeled with the term syndemic. In short, it is the argument of my presentation that the growing threats to 21st century global health are not isolated individual infectious or chronic diseases, but an ever more complex array of interacting diseases of all kinds. These include infectious and chronic diseases, as well as chronic infectious diseases, mental health problems, behavioral conditions, toxic exposures, malnutrition, and enduring stress and physical trauma, the spread of which is being driven by the four deadly horsemen of social inequality, environmental degradation, armed conflict, and global market restructuring. To the degree that identifying distinct eras of epidemiological transition is still a useful approach to conceiving the history of global health, syndemics promise to be a critical component of another alteration in the global health profile of humanity. The syndemics perspective, initially within anthropology, on one of the many front lines of the AIDS pandemic, and subsequently diffused to epidemiology, public health, biomedicine, nursing, and beyond, all of whose journals now have begun to print articles on syndemic research. Diseases as distinct entities in nature, separate from other diseases and independent of the social and cultural context in which they are found, while having helped to promote biomedicine initially, has now pushed us to an inability to see certain things that are happening before us. The growth in the recognized utility of the syndemics approach is evident in the ever-increasing pace of syndemics related publications. Additionally, there is a growing awareness that many of the most damaging human epidemics across time and location, from the lethal influenza epidemic of 1918-1919 to the contemporary global AIDS pandemic, and from the Black Plague to the European diseases that devastated New World Native American populations, are the possible or probable consequence not of a single disease acting alone, but of several diseases acting in tandem, and that these adverse synergies are prompted by social conditions and unjust structural relationships. As Mark Nichter observes, the syndemic idea is a useful conceptual framework for social science investigations into global health inequality that are sensitive to environments of risk and agents promoting risk, and that takes us beyond a narrow conception of groups at risk and risky behavior. Additionally, it has come to be recognized that healthcare must increasingly address the management of individuals with multiple coexisting diseases, especially if those diseases do not merely coexist, but if they are changed by their co-presence. The syndemic approach is characterized by three features. First, it's interesting, I've fallen behind, as I often do. There we go. First, the syndemics perspective draws attention to the multiple and often intricate interconnections that occur between comorbid diseases and other health-related problems in a population at the biological, behavioral, and social levels. Demarcating individual diseases given and giving them unique labels like AIDS or TB, etc., and intently focusing on understanding their unique nature, array of signs and symptoms, immediate causes, has allowed the development of modern pharmaceutical, surgical, and other biomedical treatments. Nonetheless, it has become increasingly evident that diseases and other health conditions, such as malnutrition, stress, violence, victimization, and trauma, do not exist in isolation, nor do they necessarily merely coexist. Instead, diseases can interact in substantially adverse ways that impact individuals and populations they burden. A syndemic approach allows a new way of thinking about disease outcomes in relational rather than categorical terms. In other words, instead of focusing on an ever more powerful lens on the part, as has been the case historically in both biomedicine and public health, syndemics theory draws attention to the whole and to the various connections among parts, including how they promote and reinforce each other and create thereby complex health conditions. As Chadwick comments about the notion of species, if you look at them one way, you see individual things. Look the other way, you see processes, relationships, things together. Secondly, syndemics theory points to the fundamental importance of the interacting social and environmental conditions that promote the spread of diseases as well as their health impact at the individual and group levels. In this regard, syndemics theory focuses attention on disease concentrations or clusters, that is, at least two but possibly multiple comorbid diseases and other health conditions. The various pathways and processes through which diseases interact, and the ways this interaction increases overall disease burden beyond the mere additive presence of two or more diseases. Finally, in keeping with its focus on connections and crossing points, syndemics theory conceptualizes disease in terms of the encompassing biocultural and biosocial environment. Unlike traditional environmental models, however, nature is not conceived in syndemics theory as natural, in the sense of being separate from and independent of human action, an isolated reserve of non-human things and wild places. Rather, there is a strong concern with the syndemic within the syndemic perspective about the historic ways the physical environment has been shaped and influenced by human action, intentional and otherwise, including the ways its impacts on so-called natural environments, no less than built environments, are a reflection of inequalities within and across societies. The latter is of keen importance because syndemics commonly are found among subordinated groups precisely because of their social status. Secondly, the existence of power in society shapes the human imprint on the physical environment. And third, effective public health response to syndemics requires a focus on underlying causal factors. As epidemiologist Nancy Krieger comments, thinking critically and systematically about intimate and integral connections between our social and biological existence, and especially in the case of social production of disease and eco-social theory, to name explicitly who benefits from and is accountable for social inequalities in health. Interest in syndemics perspective has been driven by a growing evidence of the regularity of interaction among diseases and the recognition that these contacts influence disease course, expression, severity, transmission, diffusion, and response to treatment. Several different kinds of interaction among diseases have been described, including both direct, that is, changes caused by one disease that facilitate another disease, and indirect interface, that is, several diseases acting together and causing ill health. In some syndemic interactions, such as the one between diabetes and SARS, changes in biochemistry or damage to organ system caused by one disease, such as the weakening of the immune system, promotes the progression of another disease. Similarly, there is evidence that periodontitis, the progressive loss of the soft tissue that surrounds and supports the teeth, may also be a consequence of a syndemic involving the promotion of one type of infection by another. Another syndemic links periodontal diseases with diabetes, obesity, and several interrelated inflammatory conditions. A different kind of syndemic relationship involves one disease enhancing the virulence of another. This is evident, for example, in the case of herpes virus and its effect on HIV infection, with progression to AIDS being significantly accelerated by co-infection with herpes. Alternately, one disease can assist the physical transmission of another, as seen in the case of syphilis and HIV co-infection. Direct interaction of diseases is seen in the case of gene mixing among different types of pathogenic agents, as has been described in various species or even different strains or clades of the same pathogen. In some cases, co-infection may open up multiple syndemic pathways. A lethal synergism has been identified, for example, between influenza virus and pneumococcus, a likely cause of excess mortality from secondary bacterial pneumonia during influenza epidemics. In other cases, syndemic interaction among diseases is apparent, but the linkages have not yet been established. Other pathways involve emotional systems, such as the interaction between food disorders, like anorexia and diabetes, in which insulin, for example, insulin-dependent diabetics restrict their insulin intake because of the fear that it will contribute to weight gain, but then suffer the effects on their diabetes of not taking insulin. Specific studies of syndemics have revealed their significance in human health. The WHO World Health Survey, for example, which studied a sample of almost 250,000 adults from 60 countries to understand health-related outcomes and their determinants, used four chronic diseases, angina, arthritis, asthma, and diabetes, to determine mean health scores. The study found that on average between 9.3% and 23% of study participants with one or more of these chronic diseases also suffered from comorbid depression. Notably, the lead researcher who conducted this study concluded that depression produces the greatest decrement in health compared with the chronic diseases, angina, arthritis, asthma, and diabetes. The comorbid state of depression incrementally worsens health compared with depression alone, with any of the four chronic diseases, any of those chronic diseases alone, and with any combination of chronic diseases without depression. Similarly, SARS when it was actively spreading, was consistently found to produce the worst outcomes, including death, when it was syndemically linked with chronic ailments like diabetes and heart disease. In Hong Kong, for example, an analysis of 1,700 cases found that the case fatality rate for patients diagnosed with comorbid chronic conditions was 46% compared with 10% for patients without such conditions. Likewise, a case of pathogen-pathogen interaction, women with HPV cervical infection who also were infected with HIV had a 1.8 to 8.2 times higher rate of viral shedding, that is latent HPV reactivation and recurrence, compared with women not infected with HIV. The mechanics and significance of syndemics, as well as the utility of a syndemic's perspective, can be illustrated by examining the interaction of chronic alcoholism and HIV infection. Both of these conditions are known to have damaging effects on brain function, including cognitive and motor impairments expressed as diminished diminished executive functions, memory, comprehension, and speed of cognitive processing. Moreover, a growing body of clinical research indicates that a duly diagnosed individuals, there is an adverse synergism of HIV and alcoholism on brain function, which is consistent with neuroimaging reports of compromised hippocampal and associated member structures. Neuropsychological studies of cognitive functioning have shown that comorbid individuals perform worse on established assessment batteries than do single diagnosed chronic alcoholic or HIV infected groups. Notes Edith Sullivan, who has directed some of the key studies in this endemic, quote, chronic heavy drinking co-occurring with HIV infection is highly prevalent, and the separate and combined untoward effects on the brain and its processes can be significant and disruptive activities of daily life. While the precise pathways of disease interaction remain to be defined, it is evident that they involve both behavioral, that is, drinking to self-medicate, emotional costs of HIV infection, contributions of chronic drinking to HIV risk behavior, etc., and biological factors, accelerated hippocampal damage, alcohol-related HIV disease progression through reduced immunocapacity, etc. While the interaction of chronic alcoholism and HIV can occur in any sector of society, social and economic marginalization appear to play a significant role in this endemic. In a study of three urban communities in Cape Town, South Africa, for example, Seth Kalkman, who happens to be at University of Connecticut, where I'm at, and co-workers report that significant factors in this relationship between drinking and sexual risk for HIV are the pressures of living in poverty. These researchers found that individuals who perceived greater stress resulting from violence, crime, discrimination, reported greater risk for HIV infection, and that alcohol was related to both perceived stress and HIV risk behavior. In a systematic review of the literature on alcohol use and sexual risk for HIV infection in sub-Saharan Africa, Kalkman and co-workers found that one of the factors linking poverty, drinking, and HIV risk is transactional sex. Additional factors include sexual coercion and assault on women. For the sufferers of the chronic alcoholism HIV infection syndemic, consequences include facing challenges in maintaining prescribed medication regimes for HIV infection, keeping medical and other appointments, management of routine daily tasks, and fulfilling emotionally important interpersonal and kinship responsibilities. Immediate intervention implications of this syndemic include the simultaneous targeting of drinking patterns among individuals living with HIV, focusing on drinking establishments of prevention as sites of prevention education, the close monitoring of duly diagnosed individuals to ensure appropriate complex treatment, and the provision of training that assists individuals in handling cognitive and motor impairments. In addition, there is a critical need for broader intervention that addresses the social origins of this endemic, including factors like poverty and discrimination. As indicated by the Centers for Excellence for Health Disparities Research at Georgia State, differences in health experience caused by racial, gender, and socioeconomic inequality that contribute to differing outcomes constitute syndemics of disparity. Doesn't like me anymore. Thank you. Given it, when Pat gives her comments, you give an especially loud applause for her. Importantly, as the case of alcohol HIV suggests, the term syndemics points beyond interactive biology, emotional states, and behavior to the role of social conditions and the structures of social relations in the development of disease concentrations, the frequency of disease interactions, and the health outcomes of syndemic disease. In syndemics, the interface among diseases or other health-related problems commonly reflects a configuration of adverse social factors that put subjugated individuals and groups at heightened risk for disease exposure while limiting their access to prevention and treatment. Additionally, as a result of various effects of being subject to discrimination, suffering social rejection, enduring stigmatization, and internalizing oppression, as well as exposure to noxious living and working conditions, subjugated populations commonly encounter new disease threats while already enduring less than optimal health, including compromised immune and other body systems. As a result of this vulnerability, diseases cluster among subordinate populations, increasing the likelihood they will suffer syndemics. This pattern can be seen, for example, in the mortality and morbidity statistics for African Americans living in the U.S. While life expectancy for white males in the U.S. is 76.7 years at that conversion point, for African American males, it's only 67.8 years, a deficit of about 8 years. Among white females, the average life expectancy is 79.9 years, compared to 74.7 years for African-American females, a deficit of about 5 years. African-Americans have been found to be at significantly greater risk of death, including premature death, than whites. Most existing studies show a 30% higher age-adjusted risk of mortality among African-Americans. Much of the difference, which reflects a greater disease burden, is explained by differences in socioeconomic status. Analyses of several national studies by Franks and co-workers, however, found that an additional mortality burden among African Americans after statistical adjustment for SES is a consequence of the health damage caused by being subjected to racism and related forms of discriminatory treatment that result in various adverse chemical changes in the body of stressed populations that are directly linked to health damage. Moreover, lower SES and being subjected to racism have been found to interact, multiplying the damaging health effects of each condition. Further, poor people in cities with smaller impoverished populations have been found to be at lower risk of dying than those in cities with large and more densely crowded impoverished populations. Not only being poor, but the compactness of poverty in an area appears to be crucial determinant of health among the poor. Moreover, studies of differences by location among the poor show that the psychosocial physical environment in which people live, that is, their conscious experience of their surrounding community, including issues of danger, stress, comfort, and appeal, is also an important determinant of their health condition. Feelings of hopelessness and powerlessness in a community have been found to be a good predictor of health risk and health status. There is, in short, a biology of poverty and social injustice that puts subjugated populations at heightened risk. Such conditions seep under the skin to make people sick and highly vulnerable to syndemics. A recent example of this pattern is seen in the case of antimicrobial drug-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. This staph strain, which can cause skin infections, usually mild but capable of developing into pneumonia, was first described in hospitals and nursing homes. It was, in fact, the first bacterium in which resistance to penicillin was discovered just 4 years after the drug entered into mass production. A new study by Hota and co-workers found that the greatest risk of infection included prior experience with incarceration, being African American, and residence in public housing. Being poor and a marginalized ethnic minority, in conjunction with living conditions and experiences that this entails, from overcrowding to lack of sanitary conditions to frequent incarcerations, has become a risk factor for what began as a disease of clinical settings. In the same way, HIV, which was first observed among gay men, became a disease of the poor and of ethnic minorities in the U.S. and globally. Frydenberg and colleagues, for example, have described this endemic that comprised HIV, TB, and street violence among the inner-city poor of New York City that began in the mid-70s. This endemic was produced by oppressive social conditions, exacerbated by public budget and policy decisions involving cuts to health and social programs intended ostensibly to save money for the city. Instead, they contributed to deteriorating conditions, a 20% rise in the number of poor people in the city, despite an overall population decrease of 10%, and a rise in the health burden of the poor. As a result, TB rates in New York began to go up after a century of decline, producing an excess of 50,000 TB cases beyond what was expected. AIDS cases also shot up, especially among drug users. Thus, by 1985, there were an estimated 250,000 drug addicts in New York City, only 30% of whom were in drug treatment. Rates of homicide in the city also began to rise in the late 70s and continued to climb through the 90s, resulting in the death of over 20,000 people. Today, syndemics are being identified around the world as researchers begin to focus on the nature of various connections among diseases and the social context factor that examines these kinds of disease concentrations and interactions with social conditions. From a syndemics research perspective, further advances in understanding the nature of syndemic processes under conditions of globalism, global warming, and other social changes requires, and environmental changes, requires pursuit of several lines of inquiry. First, there's a need for studies that examine the precise physical and social processes by which syndemics emerge, including the set of health and social conditions that foster the co-occurrence of multiple epidemics in population and how syndemics function to produce specific kinds of health outcomes and help reproduce particular hierarchies of inequality. Second, there's a need to better understand processes and pathways of interaction among various diseases, as well as between diseases and other adverse health factors like malnutrition, structural violence, etc. Third, there is a need for a closer examination of how environmental changes like global warming enables the spread of diseases and other impacts on human health and its consequences, particularly for oppressed populations, as diseases spread to new environments and interact with native diseases in novel ways. Finally, there is a need for better understanding of how public health and medical systems, as well as communities and nations, can respond to limit the health consequences of syndemics and the social conditions that cause them. Beyond research, there is an ever-pressing need for significant social action, including structural change, towards a global system that is committed to meeting people's basic needs and achieving social inequality and justice, democracy, and environmental sustainability. Failure to do so portends Paul Epstein's apt phrase, promises us a sick future. Thank you.
Do you need water? Thank you, Merrill, for a great talk. We're going to have to hold off on questions for Merrill. We'll invite him back to the podium in a few minutes. But before he comes, I'm going to invite Pat Antonello, our very own, a member of our New York Academy of Sciences Anthropology Section Committee, and also the former co-chair of the committee right before Rudy and I took over. Pat is an associate professor at Brooklyn College in anthropology and archaeology, and also is one of the founding faculty members of the MPH program there. She works at the intersection of public health, anthropology, and human rights, and she has two forthcoming books coming out with great titles, which I'm going to share with you now. They're fantastic titles. One is called Public Good, Women's Health. What? Women's Health and Inequality in Rural India. Women, Health, and Inequality in Rural India. See, I can't even, but it's a great title. And the second one is a parallel volume called Money in Her Hand, Microfinance and the Banking of Women. So we look forward to those books coming out, and and we invite you to the podium to respond to Merrill's really great paper.
Thank you. I want to thank Jeff and Rudy for inviting me and to comment on this brilliant paper and concept. Okay. Thank you. And to thank the staff of Winogren for your continuing support. And I would especially like to thank Jeff and Rudy for the great job they're doing at organizing these seminars. So I think we need to. Okay, so can we turn this thing off? I tried to. Okay. So Merle's accomplishments and publications, as Jeff said, are too numerous to mention, although Jeff tried. But it's an honor for me to be discussing this incredible contribution to anthropology, public health, and biomedicine. And I enjoyed preparing this response in searching databases and surfing the net and YouTube to try to get a handle on the scope of syndemics as it's emerging as a concept and a methodological and theoretical tool. And, of course, Merle's book, Introduction to Syndemics, which a critical systems approach to public and community health, is an essential document for understanding all of this. And I hope people who didn't understand what syndemics was before the talk began do now. So first, what Merle was too modest to reiterate here is that he is considered the germinator, or I'm trying to find a gender-neutral term, the genitor, of the term and the concept and the theory of syndemics. And as the Centers for Disease Control website puts it, quote, scholars and practitioners have long observed interactions among diseases, but it wasn't until the early 1990s that anthropologist Merle Singer suggested that empirical connections among epidemics might signify the existence of a higher-order phenomenon or a syndemic. And again, from the CDC website, when Merle Singer coined the term syndemics in the early 1990s, he crystallized into a single work an important but often neglected strand of thinking about how people actually experience health problems, particularly those who have been excluded from society's full respect and protection. So the concept itself continues to have a life of its own. For example, on Google, which I've been told is only 10% of access to cyberspace, the term syndemics gets 5,200 results in 0.16 seconds. Do you know all of this, Merle? Okay. And the term syndemics gets 36,800 results in 0.7 seconds. And there is a Wikipedia page for syndemics in which Merle is credited with introducing the concept. And more impressively, there's a Wikipedia page on Merle Singer, in which it says Dr. Singer also developed the public health concept also of syndemics and oppression illness. So on Scopus, which is an academic citation index, Merle's 2003 Medical Anthropology article, Syndemics in Public Health, gets 61 citations. Another article, Nobody Gives a Damn If I Live or Die, 53 citations. And my favorite title, Syndemics, Sex, and the City, gets 43 citations. So the centers of, and there is a CDC website, the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention website itself, called the Syndemic Prevention Network, links to the CDC.org, 204 sites for syndemics, 249 for syndemics, and for Merle's name himself, 57. And not only, wait, I didn't go to Facebook, but not only, who did? Oh, well, I missed that. But not only that, there is Syndemics the Movie, right, on YouTube. If you go to YouTube, there are a bunch of titles, but most of them are art videos, and I wasn't sure if you'd verged into that, I figured. Right, but they're not related to you. But anyway, but there are also two very important videos about syndemics, one from the International HIV-AIDS Conference in 2010, and another introducing the National Center for AIDS, Viral Hepatitis, STDs, and TB, with Ken Fenton, who's the director, saying that this site is a research tool to help confront syndemics. That's what he says on. Okay, and also, there is Syndemics the Video Game. I kid you not, on the CDC site of the Syndemics Prevention Network, there's a link to a game called Healthbound Policy, Healthbound Policy Simulation Game. So clearly Merle has made an unparalleled contribution with the development of this concept of syndemics, which has become an industry unto itself. And that's one of the things I want to talk about tonight. So what I want to raise tonight are questions about the origin of the concept and its implementation for addressing issues of inequality within the public health biomedical complex where it now resides. So the origins that I traced back were to 1992 of Singer and Snipes, where the quote is, a set of closely related and mutually reinforcing endemic, epidemic, and pandemic conditions to call attention to the synergistic nature of health and social problems facing the poor and underserved. So that was sort of the first definition of it. And then later, the next definition in 94 was the actual term syndemics that referred to the definition that we have now, a set of synergistic or intertwined and mutually enhancing health and social problems facing the urban poor, and that reveals the likely relationship of these diseases to the larger syndemic health crisis and thus to poverty and social inequality. So in the book, Introduction to Syndemics, Merle begins by looking at key concepts. And one of the key concepts he looks at is Thomas Kuhn's book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And there's an important parallel here that I'll get back to. But one of the things that Merle is looking at is, and this is a quote from his book, in any specialized subfield, including biomedicine, science tends to be guided by the reigning paradigm. That is, we'll get back to the term paradigm, that is, by a, quote, entire constellation of beliefs, values, and techniques, and so on, that are shared by members of a given community. So I have a problem page of my paper, but I will try to go on. So what I want to raise here is this, you're using the Kuhn thing to talk about thinking inside the box. And what I want to raise here is this notion in public health of, or this gambit of, whether to think inside the box or outside of the box, or what is normally taking place within the box. So one of my questions is, how has this idea of syndemics been sucked into the vortex of biomedicine and public health? Because many of these comparisons have nothing to do with underlying social inequalities, which is what you first began, even though we're still talking about this. So my concern about extending Kuhn's concept is, has syndemics now become part of the box? It's not thinking outside the box, but it's part of being inside the box. And this, I think, gets to be a problem when you're comparing these three different communities of biomedicine, public health, and anthropology, who have their own long histories, theory, methods, practical application, and biases, and each perspective with a different purpose or way of defining concepts. So, for example, even the concept of health, defined by the World Health Organization, which includes a social concept with a biomedical definition, does not, of health, which is a state of, this is the World Health Organization definition, a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. And then the Alma-Ata Conference of 1978 added the notion of it as a fundamental right. But with biomedicine using census categories to look at social categories, how have the historical and political significance of these units of analysis of, for example, the individual, and the purpose of using symptomatology, including technology, to make a diagnosis, to treat the patient, to return the person to the individual to normality? And actually, I'm quoting Sociology in Medicine by another Susser, where the point is, what physicians have taken as a given about disease, social science makes problematic. So for the physician, the goal of practice is to cure or care for the individual afflictions. And in standard medical texts, the treatment requires the sort of training that only a specialist can offer. But social science and these social science concepts go beyond the individual body and look at the social determinants of affliction, about how disease originates and how it makes its appearance in society, which was the original purposes of addressing this concept of syndemics. But on the other hand, public health is a process of mobilizing and engaging local, state, national, and international resources to assure conditions in which people can be healthy. And in some examples, in population, it looks at populations and reduces it to variables of social categories. And these variables are given various weights. So as Krieger, who writes extensively and critically about the use of social class, points out, that these variables are used as modeling variables. So social class is conceptualized as a nominal categorical variable pertaining to models and ordinate numbers and the like. So these two categories have very different notions of understanding what these definitions of inequality are, and then how to operationalize these definitions. So within anthropology, some have used syndemics, such as Heron and Spaten-Spiegel, have used the word syndemics in order to look at two competing diseases that are affecting a particular population, but they're not looking at the underlying social causes of this. So they're looking at, they're using the word social as a modifier to say social environment, social activity, social conditions, social influences, but they're not looking at the underlying social causes of disease. So given the competing and contrasting questions by biomedicine, public health, and anthropology, how with these three areas, for example, would we begin to look at the endemics of inequality, right, which is where Merle starts. So can we use this approach to explain, for example, the horrific events of the last 4 weeks and the bias we've all just been forced to experience? So in terms of underlying factors that affect inequality, so, for example, how can we account for the most extreme cynical sexism we have witnessed against Sandra Fluke, for example, by Congress and others? And can we account for such things as institutional racism surrounding the case of Trayvon Martin? And the talk shows are buzzing about ideas of individual motive, stereotyping, but few connect institutional racism and sexism to these individual actions. While some psychiatrists are talking about the problems of bias in diagnosing African Americans with mental health issues, other studies show that in making diagnosis, that there is racism and sexism in many studies, and this is based on one study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, documenting that when biomedicine starts looking at these factors, it is an underlying racism and sexism generating from the biomedical model that is causing the analysis of these things to be influenced by these models. So this synergism of institutional racism and the internal stereotyping that have been shown to happen in biomedical diagnosis are a factor when we're trying to look at these underlying inequalities that are affecting disease and that are incorporated into a notion of syndemics. So, for example, in looking at race bias, as Mulling points out, the racial differentials in disease, which are perceived as genetic in origin, have more to do with the position of African Americans in the social hierarchy than with genetic factors or with cultural choices. So how do physicians think about excluding the underlying factors of inequality that might be the synergistic cause of problems in a syndemic, or including them as part of the analysis? And how do we account for institutional racism in medicine? And are biomedical studies that gloss over institutional racism and other structural inequalities an impediment to showing a syndemics of inequality? So how can we tease out the social conditions of inequality regarding the embeddedness of racism, classism, sexism, and heterosexism in medical practice? But in the text, Merle states that to the degree that it encourages a focus not just on disease interactions, but on the fundamental importance of social conditions that foster disease clustering and its interface, syndemic theory also represents a paradigmatic shift in the understanding of what disease is and how it is manifested in complex biofeedback environments. So what I'm asking is, are we now at that point of that paradigmatic shift, especially when it comes to understanding the underlying inequalities that are affecting health? So finally, in Chapter 6, which is titled Inequality as a Cofactor, Merle gets at operationalizing these underlying causes as he's outlined tonight. And we look at how anthropologists who are looking at individuals on the ground are operationalizing this. And the example that's given is a discussion of cholera in Peru using Kim et al., who hopefully will be the next head of the World Bank. This is John Young Kim. And how these issues, underlying issues of inequality are caused were directly caused by the structural adjustment policies in Peru. So when we use concepts like poverty or social determinants of health, are we getting at these underlying causes, like the relationship among gender inequality, maternal mortality, infant mortality, and racism? And I know that's the goal, but the question is, how are we looking at these baseline definitions, and who is using these definitions? So how are we to understand the embeddedness of the fundamental causes of poverty based on these global inequalities if we don't have studies that show variation by location of political economy issues such as caste, class, and gender inequality in India, or in the United States, racism, classism, or class inequality, especially when research on gender inequality itself is frequently absent. So to sum up, the recent World Health Organization Commission on the Social Determinants of Health created a group called Women and Gender Equity Knowledge Network. And one of the analysis of this was looking at how, quote, gender inequality damages the health of millions of girls and women across the globe. It can also be harmful to men's health, despite the many tangible benefits it gives men through resources, power, authority, and control. And gender relations of power constitute the root cause of gender inequality and are among the most influential of the social determinants of health. So getting down to these root causes is one of the questions I have about how effective these syndemic analyses are going to be, especially when, as I said, it's now been co-opted into the vortex of the media and the CDC establishment, which has its advantages. So I'll just end with, again, going back to Thomas Kuhn, The Structure of Scientific Revolution. Maybe because I think the term paradigm, which came out of that work, and the term syndemics might have the same impact and significance on science, so that Merle will continue to have a website and get more grants and write more about this. But also because in the second edition of his book and in the postscript, Kuhn responds to his critics who were reinterpreting how the word paradigm is using. So I'm wondering if you feel that the model, as it's currently being used, has been implemented, especially by public health and biomedicine, sufficiently to address the issues of inequity and the underlying inequality that was the first formulation of the concept of syndemics. Okay. Thank you.
Do you want to come back?